Okay, hello everyone. Thanks again for listening to this next episode of the podcast. We're quite happy that we got one. Well, I'm quite happy that we got one out again pretty quickly after our last discussion with Peter on the quantum internet. But today we've actually got three guests Skyping in from the UK to talk about the, I won't say much anticipated result because, as many of you know, it was leaked several weeks ago, but the Google supremacy paper, which is quite a big milestone for quantum technology. So with me today, I've got Ashley Montanaro from the University of Bristol, with Ryan Mann, who's also just recently joined Ashley Montanaro at the University of Bristol, and Michael Bremner from UTS in Sydney, who are all over in Bristol at the moment. I'm sure having a wonderful time. So guys, thanks for joining me today on the podcast.
Hi, Simon. It's great to be here. No
So,
worries.
first of all, the three of you have been certainly involved when it comes to looking at algorithm development for quantum computing, and most notably the algorithms that Google were at least trying to use when they were doing these experiments. So maybe we should start off and try and have a bit of a discussion on the idea on of algorithmic development and, most importantly, complexity theory, because we're sort of going to get into this algorithm a bit later, as to what it does and what it doesn't do. But let's try and motivate the story a little bit as to what this idea of complexity theory is in the classical space, what it means for quantum, and what was the motivations behind the derivations of this supremacy protocol.
Okay, great. So maybe I can start out with saying some things, and Mick and Ryan can jump in whenever they feel like. So, computational complexity theory, like, is this theory that goes back many years in classical computer science, which somehow is one of the most fundamental aspects of computer science that we can think of, and it tries to work out like how hard different problems are, like different families of problems, I should say, like more precisely. So, rather than looking at a particular instance of a problem, like for example, doing a particular crossword, like it looks at a whole family of problems, like doing arbitrary size crosswords, and tries to work out how hard it is to solve that family of problems as the size of the problem grows. And amazingly, it turns out you can classify problems by their complexity, and you can say, okay, this problem is harder than this other problem in a sort of theoretically rigorous way. The only downside is that often it's very hard to sort of mathematically prove this. Like, computational complexity theorists have spent many years dividing problems into complexity classes, but often they can't show that one class is not equal to another class. They can't show that class A of problems is actually harder to solve than class B. And this whole theory has been extended to quantum computing as well. And sorry, the background there, we just had Siri saying,
It was
yeah, it
Google.
was Google saying, apologies, I don't understand. An absolutely perfect moment.
Well, it's not bad. We're going to keep that in.
That was awful. Well done, phone.
Like this whole theory has also been extended to quantum computing. So we have various complexity classes for quantum algorithms because quantum computing is fundamentally different to classical computing. So this whole theory needs to be ported across to the quantum domain. And we think that some of these complexity classes are different to the classical ones. We think there's things that we can do with a quantum computer that we can't do with a classical computer. And really, like the whole world of quantum computing is trying to sort of make this a reality and trying to come up with experiments that demonstrate these quantum algorithms that are doing things that we can't do classically. And okay, I'll switch over to Mick and Ryan in case they want to add
I think that's quite a solid answer.
anything.
Yeah, I like the crossword analogy. That was good. But I think, well, to elaborate on that a little bit, what complexity theory is really all about is about quantifying resources for doing computation. Like, and trying to develop a theory of understanding what are the necessary components that go into solving a problem. So that could be time, it could be space, it could be memory, it could be the amount of communication required to solve a problem. And yeah, the complexity theory is about formalizing that and understanding the relative difficulty of different families with problems.
So we have sort of a structure of things that are provable, or are these things that, you know, are best guesses? Are we having examples of problems where, you know, we really think it is hard simply because somebody isn't smart enough to find a good algorithm for it? Or no, there is something much more fundamental that nobody's going to find a good algorithm to do one of these really, really hard problems.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So we have both of these things. So in the context of quantum computing, like a really nice example is the problem of integer factorization, like starting out with a big number and breaking it down into its prime factors. And this is a problem which people are very interested in solving for lots of reasons. For example, it would enable us to break the RSA crypto system if we could do this. So people have spent many years trying to find an efficient integer factorization algorithm, but no one's been able to do it. But with a quantum computer using Shor's algorithm, we can solve this problem efficiently. But there's no sort of rigorous statement that says we can't find such an algorithm with a standard classical computer. Like, maybe there is such an algorithm, we've just not been smart enough to find it. But there are other cases where there are problems where we think there's sort of stronger theoretical evidence that we can't find an efficient classical algorithm. Because, for example, if we could, maybe it would mean that loads of other problems we also have an efficient algorithm for. So a good example of this is a problem called Boolean satisfiability, or SAT, which is what's known as NP complete. So that means that if there's an efficient algorithm for it, then there's an efficient algorithm for this whole swathe of other problems where we can check the solutions efficiently, even if we can't solve the problem efficiently. So this would be somehow even more surprising than there being an efficient integer factorization algorithm. So often, like in computational complexity theory, people are trying to find this kind of evidence that these problems are hard. Like, even if they can't rigorously prove, okay, this problem is definitely harder than this other problem, they might try to find some strong evidence, like saying, okay, it would be super surprising if we could solve this problem because we could solve all of these other ones too.
So what does constitute a hard problem in this case? And what really motivates researchers to investigate this stuff?
You mean like what's an example of a hard problem, or like what would
classified as a hard problem? I mean, what makes a hard problem hard?
Okay, so I mean, Mick already mentioned resources for solving problems, and I guess the sort of most important maybe resource, or the sort of canonical one people consider, is time, like the time it takes you to solve a problem. And usually people would say that a problem that if you have an input of size n, if it takes you time that's exponential in n to solve it, then that's hard. Like, but if you have time that's polynomial in n, so it scales like n to the k for some k that's like 1, 2, 3, even 10, then this would be seen as being efficient. So often we're looking for, let's say, quantum algorithms that run in time polynomial in the input size, but classical algorithms that need exponential time.
And it doesn't just break down simply as exponential or polynomial, right? There's all weird different classifications, and this is harder than this, even though it might be easier than this. And it's quite complicated, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a bit less clear than just exponential versus polynomial. But fundamentally, that's kind of what you're trying to resolve. Is it a separation like that, especially in the case of quantum computing? However, often, go on.
Sorry, no, please continue.
So often what you're really trying to resolve is a relative difference in runtimes or memory for solving a problem. However, the way the complexity theory works is we often group problems which have similar complexity together into complexity classes. And it's not always clear that every instance of a given problem or every instance of a problem in that class necessarily might have, say, an exponential runtime. The canonical example is the class NP. And it can be the case that, you know, for depending on the structural properties of a particular instance of a problem in NP, its runtime might not actually be that bad. So, you know, there's subtleties and there's like fine-grained notions of complexity theory you have to take into account when doing these sorts of analyses.
So what fundamentally do you think makes quantum different? Do you think it is different? Do we know that it's different fundamentally from classical computers, or is it just a guess at the moment?
So I think, well, as Ashley mentioned earlier, like Chaw's algorithm, which was discovered in 1994, is a huge signpost in that it strongly says that, okay, here's an important problem, which despite a huge amount of effort, we don't have an efficient classical algorithm for it, but quantum computers do. So just that alone is a huge piece of evidence that quantum computers are more powerful. However, and this is where we get into like the Google supremacy result, fundamentally there's a difference between the way that quantum computers handle probabilities and classical computers handle probabilities. And essentially you can see that at their core, quantum circuits, the behavior of a quantum circuit is defined by potential probability functions which are considerably more complex than those that naturally emerge from classical circuits.
Yeah. So I completely agree with that. And I guess I would also add that as well as these two arguments that somehow quantum seems very different and there's these algorithms which we've never been able to reproduce classically despite much trying, there's also some more, let's say, theoretical arguments that say that if we could simulate quantum computations in some specific ways with some specific like bounds on errors and things like that, then we would have some very surprising complexity theory consequences. So there's this whole tower of complexity classes that's called the polynomial hierarchy, which I guess the details are not so important for this podcast, but if we could exactly simulate quantum computers, then this whole hierarchy would kind of collapse down to a certain level. And if you're a practitioner, probably you don't know or care about this, but if you're a complexity theorist, this would be super surprising to you. So somehow we have these different strands of evidence that strongly suggest that quantum computers are doing something that classical computers can't do. And it's the fact we can put these together that makes it sort of quite a compelling argument. So
essentially, we don't have any rock-solid proofs, but it would surprise the hell out of a lot of very smart people if it turned out that classical computers can do everything a quantum computer can do and basically put us all out of a job.
That last question is a good point, because maybe we'd all just end up writing quantum-inspired algorithms for classical computers if we did that. But I think that's it. It's like we have no rock-solid proof, but it would just be really surprising, I think, for many, many very smart people.
Yeah, and I think the thing which has happened in the last 10 years is the evidence, the complexity theoretic evidence for the classical difficulty of simulating quantum computers has really increased. Like when I started working on these sorts of problems more than 10 years ago, 15 years ago, I'm not sure, I have to think about that. But when we started, like there were very relatively few papers and relatively little solid evidence linking the complexity of quantum computers to classical complexity classes. And I think that's really dramatically changed in the last few years.
So as part of this paper that's finally being published from what Google have done in their experiment, they speak of something that's always confused me a little bit, this thing called the extended Church-Turing thesis. So what is this, and why is it such a prominent part of the discussion of the results coming out of this paper?
Sure. So the extended Church-Turing thesis, well, maybe it's better to start with the Church-Turing thesis, which basically dates back to the beginning of our theory of computing. So the Church-Turing thesis states that any problem that can be regarded as computable can be computed on a Turing machine. And a Turing machine, of course, is sort of the canonical model underlying computing for what we consider a computer to be. And so, you know, that's not something you can prove. It's basically a hypothesis. And the extended Church-Turing thesis adds a notion of efficiency to that argument. So in the normal Church-Turing thesis, it's all about classifying things as being computable or not computable. So when I say not computable, there is no computing machine that we think can solve that problem in any time or using any resources. Mm-hmm. However, the extended Church-Turing thesis adds in a notion of how much resources does it require to solve this. And the extended Church-Turing thesis states that any problem that could be naturally regarded as being computable can be computed in efficiently on a Turing machine. So everything we've been saying about quantum computing so far in this discussion, you can see contradicts that, because we say quantum computing is a natural model of computing. It's a thing that we think we can build, However, it seems to have like exponential advantage over classical computers. So that would say that it can solve problems that can't be naturally regarded as efficiently solvable on a classical machine. So basically, the Standard-Church-Turing thesis underlies a lot of what we think about the complexity theory.
So in this case, so quantum computing, if it works, it would refute the extended Church-Turing thesis. It wouldn't confirm it.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there are some sort of caveats, like what Mick described is ultimately like it's a mathematical statement, but about our physical universe in some way. And like, because we'll only ever be able to do finite size experiments with our quantum computers, like, you know, because our world is finite, our quantum computers are definitely finite in size. Like, it's not something that can ever be sort of mathematically rigorously refuted, but we can get amazingly good evidence that it is true. I think it's fair to say. Like, I mean, if we have a quantum computer that is solving a problem which we really think for many different reasons we can't solve efficiently classically, then that really strongly suggests the extended Church-Turing thesis is false.
Yeah, and as actually, just to add to what Ashley was saying, like, there is a bit of a subtlety about the fact that things are finite size. So then you have to sort of almost add in another assumption, which is that, you know, we know what the best algorithms are for a particular problem classically. And also underlying all this too is that we also believe complexity theory isn't broken, is the other thing that we need to assume if we're going to say the Standard-Church-Turing thesis can be violated.
So what would constitute breaking of complexity theory?
That it would be okay if the polynomial hierarchy collapsed, for instance.
Like, so does that break complexity theory, like the entire formalism of complexity theory, or does it just mean these rankings and this sort of structure that we've built up over many, many decades in computing, it just has to be reformulated?
Yeah, it would mean it need to be reformulated. It would mean that our assumptions that we'd be making about the relative difficulty of a lot of classes are not really appropriate. So we basically have to go back to the drawing board and start recasting complexity theory in a new way, which actually would be kind of exciting too, actually. I mean, a lot of the things we thought we understood, we didn't really understand. And I think that's kind of an exciting outcome if that was a thing that would turn out to be true.
Yeah, so to a certain extent, it's like if somebody found a uncontroversial experiment that basically broke quantum mechanics. You know, it seems to have worked all the time. We found something hugely anomalous that makes us rethink everything. But we would just have to rethink everything.
Yeah, totally. And actually, as a scientist, to me, that's actually kind of a really exciting thing, right? Like, when you have huge unknowns emerging, that means we get to explore all sorts of cool new ideas. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that would be, you know, if that turned out to be false, well, you know, I see that as a great opportunity to learn new things and try new things.
Because the other part of what you said there, the other caveat was whether or not we could be definitive about whether or not we found the best classical algorithm. This sort of starts segueing in to the formalism of what the Google experiment did. And, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but this problem known as boson sampling that was developed 2012, if I recall correctly, this was one of the first attempts at being able to derive a problem where you could actually start talking about a proof for how hard this is to do classically. Am I right about this?
Yeah, I mean, it's fair to say, I mean, there have been some papers before that had some kind of hints in this direction. So I guess possibly the first one would be to Helen DiVincenzo, which is 2002 already, right, I think.
Yeah.
So, and also some previous work by Mick together with Dan Shepherd, like, had some another sort of argument that some very simple classes of quantum computers should be hard to simulate classically, but that, I guess, was based on some sort of non-standard complexity assumption. So, but boson sampling sort of marked the start of this era when people were using like this family of techniques that were developed to show some strange complexity theory consequences for efficient simulations of quantum computing, and we're using these techniques in a sort of, I guess, industrialized way to sort of like to become a tool which could be applied to many different classes of experiment.
Right. So I think the big advance that boson sampling, the boson sampling paper by Aronson and Archibald made over earlier work was that it took, there'd been several papers leading up to that, which the Aronson and Archibald, like, sort of gave a bit of background to the theory and were hinting in that direction. I think that's a word which actually is a really good word. It hinted in the right direction to go. But Aronson and Archibald found a way of taking that and then taking those results and showing how they could be applied in a situation where we have realistic notions of noise and a realistic notion of quantum computing. So some of those earlier results, they either relied on the complexity of computing functions we knew quantum computers couldn't compute. So in some sense, it wasn't a fair comparison. You'd say that quantum computers have these very hard functions which define what they were. But nonetheless, with a quantum computer, you still couldn't access those functions. They were just like the way in which you do measurement in a quantum computer restricted your ability to evaluate those things. So you'd be making these comparisons which were like, yeah, quantum computers can do this thing classical computers can't do, but we can't really measure it in the lab, and it doesn't really lead to an experiment that refutes anything at all. What Aronson and Archibald did was to take some of those results and show a way of turning that into an argument that would be robust to all the things you need to think about when you do an experimental implementation of something.
And boson sampling, I mean, that was restricted to effectively linear optics. That was the hardware formalism that they used. I don't know if you could quickly summarize exactly what the protocol was and what we saw in the intervening years when it came to demonstrations of it, and could you argue that we came close to, you know, achieving what Aronson and Archibald proposed?
So maybe I could summarize what the actual protocol was. So you're right that the boson sampling protocol was very unique to, well, the way it was presented, it was very unique to linear optics. So basically what the protocol was is that you feed a set of single photons into a linear optical network made out of simple optical elements. So things like beam splitters and phase shifters, which are in principle, normally in free space, very easy to manufacture and to play with. We understand these things very well. So what Aronson and Archibald assumed was that you can feed single photons into such a network, which is of, you know, bounded size, so polynomial size network. And then you, at the end of the network, all you do is just measure whether there was a single photon appearing in any particular path or not. It's the only thing that's what you measure. So it's quite a simple experiment. You prepare single photons, you run them through a randomly chosen linear optical network, and you measure at the end. Okay, so there's a bunch of caveats there about easy. So preparing single photons is not that easy to do physically, and measuring single photons is also not the easiest thing in the world to do. That said, this was like a lot easier than building a quantum computer. So this got people very excited. So what they were able to show was that doing this kind of physical operation, you know, you're going to end up at the end performing measurements and all these photons popping out of your linear optical network. And there's a probability distribution over the potential outcomes. What they argued was that classically simulating the events in that probability distribution up to a reasonable notion of distance or noise is classically hard to do without the polynomial hierarchy breaking. That said, there was a couple of other conjectures thrown in there too. One of them was about how random these systems actually are. So that's a very technical mathematical conjecture. And the second one was about the properties of the complexity of randomly chosen instances of this problem. So they assumed that the complexity of a random network is the same as the complexity of the worst case instances that can appear in this network. So that sounds like it's a fairly strong assumption, but it's not an unusual assumption at all when you understand the sets of problems which underlie the complexity of this protocol. It's quite a natural thing, actually, for that class of problems to have. Though proving it is extremely hard.
So let's try and pull apart a couple of technicalities here, because I think it will make things easier when we start talking about what Google actually did. So first of all, let's have a bit of a discussion on this idea of a sampling problem. It's not something that people see very often on a day-to-day basis. So Ash or Ryan, do you want to try and break down the idea of what is a sampling problem and why do we see this so much in quantum protocols?
Okay, maybe I should start with like the typical class of problems, which are decision problems. So these are like some computational problem where the question is like, is it a yes or no question? Where you have to like one if it's a yes or zero if it's a no. Whereas in like quantum, a very natural thing is like the quantum computer just gives you your probability distribution. So what sampling would be doing is like drawing a sample from this probability distribution. It's like typical like a bit string.
So we might imagine that the output of the quantum computer is a string of bits, like zeros and ones, and sometimes you see one bit string, sometimes you see another bit string, and your task is to produce a particular sort of distribution, particular like histogram, you could say, of the bit strings that you see. So like in advance, you're told, okay, your task is to give this particular probabilistic outcome.
Yeah. So another way of thinking about this, to elaborate on that a little bit more, is that, so in quantum circuits, you get probabilistic outcomes at the back. And so Ashley said, you get bit strings emerging. One way of trying to simulate that would be to try and, compute the histogram of what those outcomes are. Mm-hmm. So that turns out to, this is what I was sort of alluding to earlier, this is actually a very hard problem to do for a quantum computer. And it's quite easy to show that really precisely computing that histogram is a very hard computational task. In fact, it's so hard that if you wanted to do that precisely, we don't think a quantum computer can do that either. So a quantum circuit can, be dictated by this histogram, like what it actually does, but completely describing the nature of that probability distribution is a thing that requires exponential resources to do it. That said, like you're still producing samples from a probability distribution defined by that histogram, right? And so the classical task, the task that we want to reproduce if we're trying to simulate a quantum computer is not tell us what that histogram is. It's just produce samples that are vaguely commensurate with that histogram. So that's kind of the thing to do here.
So to sort of analogize a little bit, it would be like if my computer contains 1,000 coins, fair coins, 50-50 coins, that if I just kept flipping time and time and time and time again until the end of eternity, I flip an infinite number of times, the distribution I should see is flat. Everything's 50-50. Every heads or tails string I could get over those 1,000 coins are equally likely. But in order for me to be able to reconstruct that distribution, I would have to flip for eternity. But what you're saying in this case for quantum programs is it's the same kind of effect, but it's not a flat distribution. The distribution is dictated by the quantum circuit that you're running. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. So you don't get a completely flat distribution. You get one that has some sort of peaks and troughs in it. And in fact, that's a sort of critical point about the Google quantum supremacy experiment, that's the way that they certify the distribution. Their test is sensitive to these peaks and troughs.
And so the idea is there a reasonable number of flips or a reasonable number of times that I can run this circuit such that the outputs from those samples that I get gives me enough information to partially reconstruct the distribution or confirm it's something rather than something else? Is that correct?
Yeah, well, this is an interesting point because it sort of touches on like the difficulty actually of verifying these experiments, because there's a number of different sort of statistical tests you might try to do on the samples that you get out. Like one of them is you get these samples, you somehow like draw a histogram and you see, okay, does it look like the histogram that I expect to see? I mean, firstly, it may be hard to even know what the histogram is you do expect to see, because this thing should be hard to compute. But also, clearly, you're going to need a lot of samples to do this. It's a very complicated thing. So you might also look for much simpler statistical tests, like you might just look for one number, which is somehow a sort of goodness criterion for the probability distribution you're actually getting from this circuit. And there are obvious sort of downsides of that, like maybe it's easier for the experiment to fool you, or maybe if you really don't trust the experiment, maybe that you imagine that there's some adversarial thing which is trying to trick you. But this at least gives you some hope that you can check that the experiment's doing what you expect, especially if you start out with some model for how it's going wrong, because you may know a lot about the physics, about how the experiment really works, and you may have some good idea about ways in which it might be going wrong.
So, Michael, let's now move on to sort of the extension of boson sampling, a work that you're involved with quite heavily, that sort of laid the foundations for the Google protocol. And before we get into the details of exactly what the protocol is or what the extension is that you got, you and your colleagues worked on, maybe we should just clarify, first of all, this term quantum supremacy. Let's try and actually define it in a pretty rigorous way. What is it? What isn't it?
Okay, just to be clear, everyone made a face when you said quantum supremacy, and can we define this in a rigorous way? So quantum supremacy, of course, was a term coined by John Preskill in a paper in, I think it was 2011 or 2012. And what he was trying to grasp was this idea that, you know, at some point we'd be able to build quantum computers that were good enough and define classes of problems that were easy enough such that quantum computers would begin to be able to do some tasks that classical computers, well, either they couldn't do it or it'd become really prohibitively hard for a classical computer to do this task. And he sort of said, well, you know, this would be the time which we've achieved, you know, we've crossed this sort of, he called it, I think, the entanglement frontier, and we would have achieved quantum supremacy. Mm-hmm. Now, what does that mean? I mean, I'm not sure that it means necessarily that the devices that you've built that can do those tasks will outperform classical computers in general, because actually probably they won't, because classical computers are really fast, can have huge memories, and can actually solve a lot of problems really well. A lot of the quantum computers we're building now, the clock speed is probably not as fast as your average computer. In fact, they're not really close in a lot of ways, but also they can't solve problems that are typically as big as those on a classical computer. Instead, we're punching for basically, you know, the sorts of problems that just get outside that scope of things that can be done classically. And maybe to explain that a little bit better, like what Google has tried to do here in this argument is to find the smallest, most compact quantum problems that are classically hard. So they try and reduce the qubit number, the circuit size, like basically build the smallest possible quantum problem that becomes prohibitively hard classically. And that's what they've done.
So it's specifically, to be hard for a classical computer to do. That's the somewhat the driving motive. Well, that is how these are constructed. They're constructed on purpose to not necessarily be useful, but just be provably classically hard to implement.
Yeah, and I mean, the way I would sort of put it is that this sort of big challenge, if you're wanting to demonstrate quantum supremacy, is you want something that is really hard for classical computers, but is also really easy for quantum computers. So somehow, the only way you can really hope to achieve this is to give up on the third thing that you might want, which is that the problem is actually useful and interesting for applications. So in the case of the Google paper and many other proposals, people actually try to do a completely random quantum circuit. So the computation that you're doing, it's like completely unstructured. Maybe there's some sort of basic level of structure, but the idea is you make it as sort of random as you can. And there's a couple of reasons why this might be helpful. Like, one is that if you do this, then there's no structure that the classical competitor can get a handle on easily to try to exploit to come up with an efficient algorithm. But also, it turns out that, maybe surprisingly, you can then try to tap into some nice theoretical arguments for proving hardness under some assumptions like we discussed before. So these sort of random algorithms, they have some nice features, but the downside is they in themselves are sort of inherently not useful for applications, although we may say a bit more about that later on.
Yeah, so I guess this brings up, like you mentioned earlier, that asked us to talk about these IQP circuits, which were kind of the stepping stone between boson sampling and what Google is doing. So, and this is work we actually put together with Ashley, mostly here at Bristol, working on this problem. So in those problems, we basically adapted the boson sampling argument to the quantum circuit model. So instead of it being an argument that was quite specific to the intricacies of the mathematics underlying linear optics, we showed that argument can be actually adapted to many other systems. So we chose a particular example because it was an easy example to get your head around, which was looking at the problem of trying to classically simulate randomly chosen IQP circuits. IQP circuits are a restricted family of quantum circuits where basically all the timings of the gates that appear in those circuits is like completely interchangeable. So it doesn't matter which gate you first. What we're able to show is the complexity of that problem is very similar to the complexity of the boson sampling problem. And I guess more importantly, we showed that the specific set of mathematical problems that determine the complexity of this, actually, they turn out to appear for many, many families of quantum circuits, including for random quantum circuits. So a lot of the assumptions we needed to make about the complexity of randomly chosen IQP circuits are basically the same assumptions you need to make for the complexity of randomly chosen circuits.
Now, is the idea when you were developing this or extending the boson sampling results to quantum circuits, is this idea that they needed to be small, that because we all know that hardware is going to initially be noisy, we're never going to get perfect qubits, and it's going to take a long time to get really, really good qubits. It was the search that you guys were on was to try and figure out something that was as small as possible to be able to implement something that was classically hard to simulate.
That was part of it. That was definitely one of our motivations. Actually, I think our biggest motivation was actually trying to show that this notion of extended Church-Turing thesis could be finding a violation of extended Church-Turing thesis could be made stronger, basically. So boson sampling suggested that, you know, the boson sampling problem gave us a doorway into a whole family of potential new ways of showing that quantum computers couldn't be classically simulated at all. And actually, a lot of our motivation, I think, in our first paper on this is we always anticipated this would be a thing you worried about when you had fault tolerance like built into your device. Mm-hmm. So we didn't really think of this as a NISQ application so much as what we were trying to do is to really lay down the foundations of what it would take to prove that classical computers couldn't be simulated. Sorry, that classical computers could not simulate quantum computers. We were trying to really improve the underlying mathematical foundations of that problem. It turned out that we focused on family of problems that are particularly physically easy to implement. So that was one of the reasons why we focused on it. But speaking for myself, one of the reasons we were looking at it mostly is because the mathematical properties of the systems was also super convenient. So like we're lucky that both it was like mathematically easier and it was physically easier to think about these problems.
So when did it become something that in particular the Google engineers or the experimentalists that sort of thought, well, hang on, this is appropriate for us? Because certainly, look, with all respect to the experimentalists, they're not reading your papers very much. So what crossed the divide there?
That's a really good question. I think so. The paper I'm referring to is a paper we put out. I think it was in 2015 on like the average case complexity of IQP sampling or something. There's a paper I wrote with Ashley, who's sitting here next to me, and Dan Shepard, who's a longtime collaborator of both of ours. And at the time, we certainly knew. So the hard problem I was saying is underlying this is a problem called, one of the problems we focused on was a problem of computing a technical thing called the partition function of the Ising model. So that's a really well-studied problem in classical complexity theory and also in condensed matter physics. So it's a thing which people have thought about for a long time. We knew when we were writing that paper that computing such problems, when computing such functions for problems on the size of like 50 to 100 qubits is really hard. So if you looked at the best computational physics results on this sort of thing, people didn't really do a good job once you got out to large numbers of qubits. Specifically also for the class of problems we cared about, where you've got like a randomly chosen Ising model problem, which is otherwise known to physicists as a spin glass problem, it's particularly hard to simulate these things or to compute these functions. So we knew that when we were writing the paper. We knew that really well. So we knew that like this problem would begin to get hard on if you had like 50 to 100 fault-tolerant qubits. And that was the way we were always thinking about this in our head. Well, we really need fault tolerance because the error rate seems to be still pretty low to do this.
Right.
At the time, it's also really important to remember that the idea of building a 50-qubit quantum computer was really weird. In early 2015, like the biggest quantum computers anyone had built would have been, you'd know this better than me, Simon. But in 2015, had anyone built a really reliable processor that was more than 10 qubits?
No, not really reliable. I mean, the first results arguing that superconductors were getting down below threshold was 2014. And
yep.
Ion traps and optics were doing thing of around 10 qubits at that time.
Paper saying that maybe if someone was able to build a device with that sort of those sort of numbers across all the elements in the device, that maybe that would be a candidate for an experimental implementation of this.
Mm-hmm.
It was mentioned in our conclusion. And we cited that paper, but definitely at the time, we certainly weren't thinking that anyone would be building a device capable of doing this in the next few years. That was, in fact, I think we had referees saying there's no way anyone's going to be able to build a device which is anything like being capable of doing this for a long time.
Right, right.
So it wasn't until we began talking to Google much later that year, it became apparent then in those discussions that they were planning to build processors that would be in the right ballpark for trying to demonstrate something like this.
And then you worked with Google on a subsequent paper about this, right? Because we sort of did this work, and then we're chatting to Google, and then it turned out that it seemed that our protocol, like using that directly, would not be the best way of demonstrating like supremacy on near-term device, which is not surprising because it doesn't use all of the features that the device has. So you want to have something which makes the classical algorithm's task as hard as possible. So you want to use all of the power of the device that you have. But then like it turned out that there were some connections between the theoretical techniques we used, which was very nice, because I think one of the other goals of our work, which we didn't touch on so far, is that really we wanted to demystify some of these arguments, like this complexity theory arguments that for physicists. So they'll be able to.
Yeah, I should say in our paper, and I think maybe you'd say goal achieved, was that like we took an argument. They're both on sampling paper. It was 110 pages. It was around 100 pages long.
Yeah, it was big.
It was very difficult for the average physicist to get their head around how this actually really worked, like what the technicalities of the result was. And our paper in 2015 was, 12 pages long? Yeah. I think we got the argument down a lot and into neatly digestible sort of bite-sized chunks that made it much easier for people to understand what was actually going on in these arguments. And that was partly luck in that somehow the mathematics of the things we chose was actually a lot easier to analyze in the end. But also we, thought a lot about how to present these things in a way which got to the core of what the actual problems were.
Obviously, it got picked up.
Well, sort of, yeah. I think before our paper was written, I think Google were already thinking about something like this, to be fair. So we haven't really touched on what Google actually are doing. Like, you know, they're performing these randomized computations, but you can see that the community at the time, there'd been a lot of work on this problem called randomized benchmarking, which is where you try and get an estimate of your fidelities or the performance of your processor through essentially performing sequences of random operations and seeing how they comparing that against what you would have expected the answer to be. So I think the idea of performing some sort of randomized circuit to benchmark your device, I'm sure they were already thinking about that really, really carefully before they talked to us. I should say actually, like, it was actually Scott Aronson that like kicked off this discussion between the complexity theory community and the team at Google. Like that was basically a very long email chain that had about 30 or 40 people on it, where we all got arguing about, you know, if you're given a 50 qubit device, what would be a really good demonstrate, a really good thing to do to demonstrate the capabilities of that device. And yeah, there was a really interesting, thorough conversation that a lot of us had, which I think, like I said, I think Google might have been thinking about this before that conversation started, but it really crystallized in their mind, it crystallized among everyone, basically, what was the right thing to go after here.
Well, so that segues quite nicely into the next topic, is how did Google do it? I mean, what did they actually do, and how did they apparently pull this off?
Okay, so maybe I'll start, and then I think it's fair to say that none of us are, you know, expert in the technical details of the experiment, so I might sort of keep this to a sort of high level, and hopefully I won't say anything too wrong about superconducting qubits. So Google built a device, a quantum computer, based around superconducting qubit technology, which consists of a bunch of little nodes in a sort of rectangular lattice, and they can then use this to run quantum algorithms on the device. And and they have some freedom in which algorithms they run. They can tune the gates that they perform, so they can do particular algorithms depending on which quantum gates they choose. Like, some of the gates are fixed and by the sort of restrictions of the experiment, but other ones they can choose which ones they run. So it gives them the ability to program the device effectively. And then what they're doing is they're using this device to run these random quantum circuits. So they're choosing which quantum gates they apply just at random according to some particular distribution of the gates. And as we've been discussing, like, this is expected to be something that's really hard to simulate on a classical computer. So there will be some sequences of gates which are easy to simulate. Like, maybe if you do nothing in the experiment, for example, like each of your gates is like the identity operation, that's probably pretty easy to simulate with a classical computer. But with a sort of random sequence of gates, we think this is probably hard. And this is what they did in their experiment. They ran a lot of different random sequences of gates, and then they look at the output from that experiment. They when you measure all of the qubits at the end of the experiment, you get some outcomes, and this will be a probabilistic process, so you'll get some distribution on outcomes. And then they have different ways of verifying that this distribution is what you might hope it is, and that it's doing something which is what it should be, and in particular something that's hard to simulate classically. And I guess maybe we'll go into a few more sort of specifics about how this works, but I don't know, Nick, do you want to add anything more to that?
No, that's about it. Like, just to summarize, what's going on is you have a 2D lattice system made up of superconducting qubits. One of the cool things about this paper is that they've used what they're calling a Sycamore processor, in which you can actually vary a little bit what the interactions are between the qubits, which gives you a bit more freedom in the way that you actually build the gates, which is physically super neat. It's not something I can talk about because I'm in no way an expert on this, but like, it's a really nice feature of their processor. Anyway, so what they do is they use that to build up. You can do sort of entangling gates, which are gates which talk to their neighbors. So qubits allow neighboring qubits to talk to one another, and they have single qubit gates, and these are chosen at random from some particular distribution that they allow. Then they measure all of them. So on some of the other and the real challenge they have here is trying to come up with, from a theoretical point of view, is how do you test whether this device is working, given it's a really big device, and as we said, computing the histogram over expected outcomes of such a device is a really hard thing to do. So how do you verify this worked? how do you distinguish between the randomness generated by the circuit and the randomness from the fact that it's not a perfect quantum processor? Like, there's definitely a lot of noise. Well, I shouldn't say a lot of noise. There's definitely noise in this processor. There's noise in the measurements. There's noise in the gates. There's noise in the state preparation. So how do you distinguish the noise that comes from, like, uncontrolled noise versus the randomness, the very large amount of randomness which is in this circuit? So they have a protocol for doing that. They call it cross-entropy benchmarking. It's very computationally intensive. It seems to have required a huge amount of computational resources to do this. They worked with the team at NASA, apparently, on doing this, using, like, supercomputers and Google's cluster and things like that. Actually, did they use Google's cluster? I'm not sure. But they definitely use serious supercomputing resources to do this.
I think they use the Google Cloud, and they also use Summit, which is at Oak Ridge, right?
Yeah,
that's right. So, yeah, so they use various different classical supercomputing hardware. So.
Yeah, and so sort of turning back to the experiment, I think one of the things that we were all looking for here is what the nature of the noise is in their system. And looking at the paper, they've done a pretty good job of explaining what they think the noise processes are in their processor. So in order to achieve this sort of supremacy bound that we're talking about, what we were really hoping to see was the per gate noise level to be around one on the maximum size of the circuit that you could produce here. And there's certainly, it looks like they're sort of in that ballpark for a lot of the time with a lot of their gates. And that's very impressive to see. The other thing that we were hoping to see is that the noise is relatively localized to the gates which are actually implemented. And that there's a very strong argument for that actually given in the paper, which is also really interesting to see.
Yeah, so you might somehow imagine that even if you can make some great individual 2-qubit gates, as soon as you put many of them together, everything starts going wrong. And like some skeptics, for example, might say, well, I have no objection to like a 2-qubit quantum computer, but I just don't think you can put 20 2-qubit quantum computers together or, you know, 100 2-qubit quantum computers together. And the results in this paper, I think, like really a very strong evidence that this objection, sort of objection, is not right, because the error rates they're seeing for these sort of simultaneous gates that are all applied together, you know, they're a bit higher than individual gates, which I guess you would expect, but they're not sort of dramatically higher. So, I mean, this is one thing that's, I think, so impressive about this device. And, like, it's the first time that anyone's put together this sort of very large number of very sort of high fidelity components and seen that the output at the end is sort of the fidelity that you might expect and hope for.
Yeah, so for me, it's like a huge advance in terms of in quantum control, like to see that you can controllably implement that many operations in a quantum system to that degree of fidelity is, it's really interesting. There's certainly very few other experiments have done anything like this before.
So how many gates roughly are they running on each experiment?
Okay, so I think what
good question.
Yeah, it's a good question. So I think that the largest runs they do is around 20 layers of where a layer is like some 2-qubit gates and then some 1-qubit gates as well. So I guess this would be, in terms of a total number of gates, I guess that you'd have like 53 1-qubit gates and then about like 25, 26 2-qubit gates per layer, right? So that would be...
I think it was more 1-qubit gates than that, but yeah.
Oh,
it might be twice that, roughly.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah, it even says here in the paper, actually. So about just over 1,000 single qubit gates and over 400 2 qubit gates over the whole circuit.
And all in a controllable way.
Yeah, well, the 2-qubit gates, you can choose where you do them, but what gate you apply in this particular experiment is kind of fixed. You calibrate it in advance, but it's sort of fixed. But the 1-qubit gates are completely, well, they have a set that they choose between, but they get to choose which gates they do.
Yeah, so but that's when you say control, but like, yeah, that's completely control. Like they're writing a computer program which is saying run this.
Yeah.
And that's what's happening.
And that's actually a critical part of this is an interesting experiment. Like, it's not saying there's this big quantum system in the lab and we can't understand it, so therefore it's kind of hard. Like, it's saying, well, we're given the task of running this quantum computation given by the circuit, And that's the thing the quantum computer can do, because we program it to do it, but we can't do it with a classical computer.
Yeah, it's quite important to understand. A lot of people misunderstand this point. Like, this is a completely programmable thing. Like, they can run one random, like, basically you're classically randomly choosing a circuit to implement. You know, like, I'm running a computer program, a computer that prints out the circuit diagram and says, here's a randomly chosen circuit diagram. They're then feeding this into their quantum computer, and it's implementing that thing. It's not like this is just some random process which is happening. It's a completely controlled circuit that has been chosen at random.
So one of the other questions people might have is, if the whole idea of quantum supremacy is to do a calculation that a classical computer can't possibly do, how are they proving that they're doing something if they can't classically verify it?
Well, I wouldn't say they can't classically verify it. They've actually done a pretty good job of classically verifying this. So the way that they did it, very roughly, is, well, okay, so we mentioned earlier that one of the really impressive features of this experiment and this device is that the noise, when you, the noise is relatively localized to the case that you perform. That's a really important feature for this sort of experiment. What that allows you to do is to say that basically, like, the way that the noise grows in a system, like, it grows as you add gates. It doesn't just spontaneously do weird things. It grows as you do stuff. So that's quite important. So what they've done is they showed, like, okay, so, you know, we have a 53-qubit device. Let's run some circuits on a smaller number of qubits, which is in no way, you know, a supremacy thing, and then benchmark, you know, that to within an inch of its life and show that that works well. They've kind of done that. And that's the thing you can do. The benchmarking is a lot easier in that case. It's still hard. Like, it's still hard in the sense of, like, I think doing the experiment would have been really hard, but it's certainly much easier computationally to do the benchmarking. And then add in more qubits as you go, right? And show that the behavior stays the same as you add in more qubits. They've also done a neat thing here where what they do is you randomly choose a circuit, and then you pull out various gates, which go, so you randomly choose a circuit on like 53 qubits, then you can pull various gates out of that circuit, and it goes from being really hard to being not quite so hard. Benchmark to make sure that that works, and then put the gates in and say, okay, we've crossed the threshold now, so this is really hard to classically simulate. And, you know, assuming physics and assuming that the world hasn't spontaneously changed, like, this is still working.
So basically, yes, you're saying that they ramp up the experiments qubit by qubit by qubit, characterize
by gate,
characterize it gate by gate, verify it classically, show everything matches up, and then they keep doing that until it becomes just too hard for the classical computer to do. But you say, well, it's worked up until this point. If we could have kept going, it would still follow this trend line unless something really weird's going on.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, more or less. Yeah, that's basically the argument. I can sort of say technically what you want to say is, like, computers, when we have a computing device, we have to assume induction is a thing that works. Like, that's sort of fundamental to computing. And they're basically showing that, right? That you can inductively say, okay, it worked up till here. We add more stuff. Nothing has dramatically changed in the way that it works. And that's what they've demonstrated. Well, that's what they're arguing. Right. Demonstrated, they have to argue it.
Yes, that's true.
It's the inductive hypothesis. It's a hypothesis.
For experiments like this one, I mean, and also if you think, like, historically, experiments and foundations of quantum mechanics, like, there are always loopholes. Like, there are always things which you might say, well, okay, there's this way the experiment might have sort of secretly failed, or, you know, which we're not understanding the results correctly. But I guess the question is, like, how paranoid do you want to be about these loopholes? Like, so I think, like, there comes a point where, like, if you're a sort of reasonable person, you sort of have to accept that something very interesting is going on, and, like, that seems, I mean, at least in my opinion, that seems to be the case with this experiment.
Well, the next question was, is there any, like, years ago when the first Bell violations were performed, there was a huge amount of work that needed to be done in order to close, you know, the various loopholes that existed to prove that no local hidden variables theory could account for the predictions of quantum mechanics. Now, it's a bit different here because we're not talking about trying to prove a fundamental part of reality. Instead, this is a computational model. This is a computational question. But are there any loopholes that you see in this experiment that, you know, really we should really try and close these things up a little bit? And how could it be improved just enough to say, look, this is unambiguous now?
Yeah, there's definitely loopholes in this experiment, that's for sure. So I think the big one is that you have to assume that they're doing the best possible way of doing the classical simulations of this circuit. So, you know, in order to argue that it's this task is really, really hard for a classical computer, like I said, I think asymptotically this task is hard. And that's also assuming that the noise in the system is below where it needs to be. Sort of in the fault tolerance regime, you can definitely argue that this sort of problem is hard. When you're not using fault tolerance, you have realistic noise. It might open the door to other simulation techniques which we haven't thought about yet. So I think that's the big loophole, is like, is there a better classical algorithm for simulating specifically these kinds of circuits with the kinds of noise that they're seeing? So, you know, can you physically reproduce, classically reproduce this kind of experiment under this sort of noise model?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the loophole. Like, so the assumption that they make actually in saying that this problem is really hard is that they, like, the best method for simulating unstructured quantum circuits that work really well, like, so non-noisy unstructured quantum circuits is a problem called, you use a technique called tensor network contraction. And Google and the teams at NASA and Google have a very nice tensor network contraction algorithm that they use to do the analysis of these circuits and to do the classical comparisons of these circuits. And then they modify this algorithm to take into account the reduced fidelity you get due to the fact it's noisy. Okay, so use a combination of tensor network contraction and other things to do this simulation. I think with regards to tensor network contraction, I'm not sure you can do gigantically better than they've done for this problem because it's very stripped down, the algorithm they're using. However, you can ask the question, did they implement it in the best way? You know, did they do it completely appropriately for the processor they were doing it on? These are all questions you can ask. I'm not an expert in those things, so I'm not going to get into that. But the other question is, like, you might argue that the amount of noise in this circuit is a bit more than you'd want to really demonstrate, you know, quantum computational supremacy, and that might open a door to a different type of classical simulation method. Right? It leaves the door a little bit open there. They haven't completely closed that.
Right, right.
Yeah. And I would say, for me as well, that there is also the loophole, which I think you sort of alluded to, Simon, about the sort of 53-qubit experiment, like the biggest one they've done. Like, it would be nice to build up somehow even more confidence that this is really working correctly. Like, because, I mean, personally, I'm not a sort of skeptic who says, well, it will work fine up to 51 qubits, but as soon as you get to 53, well, it will explode. But I think, like, their experiment has produced this huge pile of data, and it would be nice to have a way of looking at the data and really saying, okay, here's a signature that says this is very likely worked, right, this experiment. Like, without the need to sort of really believe everything that's going on in the experiment and to trust that things are behaving the same way with 53 qubits as with 51 qubits. So that's something which I think at the moment we don't have a really good theoretical handle on, some sort of nice sort of benchmarks or sort of tools that we can use to determine whether these, like, very large scale quantum computing experiments are actually working.
Yeah.
So is supremacy going to be useful in the near future, aside from being, you know, a sort of a technological waypoint to sort of say, look, we're building something, it seems to work as advertised, now we can push on to building larger and larger chipsets?
Well, I think there's sort of two questions in there. Like, one is, will supremacy type experiments be useful, like ones that you might run on this Google Sycamore chip or whatever? And the other is, like, will this sort of supremacy class of computers be useful? Because you could use, like, the same chip to run something which is not one of these random circuits, like it's something which is maybe a problem you particularly care about solving. Sure. And, like, that second question, I would say, like, we basically don't know. Like, it's in my opinion, like, it might be that devices of this size are useful for sort of, like, really sort of practical problems where you don't care if it's a quantum computer that's solving it or a classical computer, but you just want the problem solved. Like, I think more broadly, we don't know, but there's also, like, these sort of supremacy type sort of random circuits. Are those useful in themselves? And there's some sort of interesting ideas people have, in particular Scott Aronson, to do with using these random circuits to generate somehow certifiably hard random numbers in some sense. So, like, if you believe in this sort of quantum supremacy picture, the quantum computer is sampling from some probability distribution which is not accessible to sort of classical methods. So this might give you some sort of interesting types of random numbers which somehow have some certifiable randomness to them. And question of whether this is useful, I think, starts to get really technical, and it may depend a lot on the sort of model that you're thinking about and your precise use case. And I don't know if these guys know a bit more than me about this, but, like, it seems pretty subtle to me, and I think over the next year or two, we'll sort of see whether people are genuinely excited by this application.
Like I said, it really comes down to the technicalities of how you actually use that kind of random number generator, essentially. Now, actually touched on another point there, though, which is, like, for these devices to really be doing something that goes beyond classical computers, the problem seems to be, at least for these sort of 53-qubit devices, the challenge is actually finding things that aren't, like, just basically completely random, right? So most problems we care about actually have tons and tons and tons of structure. The problem with structure is you need the ability to encode structure, which means you need a bigger processor. And so this is kind of one of the biggest issues with fire. Other than the issue of noise, which is a huge problem for NIST, you know, applications, it's this problem of how do you balance structured things which might be interesting versus unstructured things for which we can really show, you know, a quantum advantage with today's processes. Finding the right trade-offs here is really hard. Like, it requires a lot of analysis.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think that's kind of the challenge. Like, how do we explore that space? Actually, I think it was Chris Ferrier wrote a piece in The Conversation a couple of weeks ago about this, you know, Google's leaked paper. And he raised the point, like, we need to learn to think about how to develop in this sort of quasi space where we have a little bit of structure but not very much. And we need to, you know, find ways of thinking about how do we explore that regime, right? So as we said, the problem with these circuits or using this sort of circuits is that, like, we can't know the complete histogram of how the circuit works, right? So we've got to find ways of coming up with algorithms which are operating in a space where we can't do the analysis we might normally rely on, right? We can't rely on classical analysis of the performance of the thing. We have to instead, like, find a way of, like, utilizing these randomized structures to, you know, to do things. I hope that made sense. That might not have made sense, but anyway.
Well, we've already gone over an hour, so everyone's getting a little bit tongue-tied, I think, at this point.
But it's definitely time for tea. It's tea time here because it's the UK.
Yes, it's beer time here because it's nearly 9:30. So just to sort of finish things off, I suppose one final question for everyone is sort of what's the next step? What does the supposed achievement of quantum supremacy in the Google device imply for the coming generation of quantum chipsets? I mean, do they work on getting the error rates better? Are they going to move straight into fault-tolerant error correction or mass manufacturing? I mean, is this a milestone that could indicate significant acceleration in the space, or is it just we've hit this waypoint, now we're going to plod along to the next one?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, on the hardware side, I think people will be trying to improve all of these things you mentioned, like trying to get error rates down, trying to scale up to bigger sizes, which is going to be really important. I mean, I think given my own interests on the sort of software and theory side, I think like finding applications for this generation of devices is really going to be critically important. And I have to briefly plug my quantum software startup, Phasecraft, which is working on exactly this kind of question, like what can we do with these devices in this NISQ regime, like noisy intermediate scale quantum regime. And yeah, the question is really open at the moment, I think it's fair to say. And like we have this sort of period of 5 years or so where like it's very unlikely we're going to have very large scale quantum computers that will have fault tolerance and will be able to run Shor's algorithm or these other kind of interesting quantum algorithms people have been developing for many years. And it's sort of really critical question to figure out what we can do with this generation of devices, because I think people don't want to wait for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years to really be doing exciting things with their quantum computers. Exciting things like from a practical point of view as opposed to the scientific point of view. Because for me, at least, these guys have a similar opinion, like this supremacy announcement is really a very exciting scientific milestone. And what remains now is to make this into a sort of practical application milestone as well.
Yeah, what Ashley said. I definitely think from an experimental viewpoint, I'm sure the team at Google, teams at Google and elsewhere, are thinking really hard about how to continually improve the processes they're developing. Like, how do you improve fidelity of individual gates? How do we get around this error in this qubit better? Like, I'm sure there's a conversation that's happening daily. These things, right? And then I'm sure there's teams of people working on like, what does the next generation chip look like? You know, do you keep the same sort of interaction pattern? Do you change the interaction pattern? Do you increase connectivity or decrease connectivity? What is the right trade-off there? That is definitely a thing people will be thinking about for a long time to come. As a more of a software and theory person, you know, I'm kind of with Ashley in that, like, I want to understand what are the applications which are really truly useful in the near term. And I think the other really interesting question, which we alluded to earlier, was like this whole problem with benchmarking. Like, are there better tools for benchmarking devices that, you know, can be sort of be both sort of rigorously interesting and maybe can sort of act as a stamp of the quality of the actual processor?
I think there was a paper that came out today from Jens and Damian Markham and a few others summarizing this very thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a really significant problem, right? Like to come up with an established set of benchmarks, we all kind of agree are sensible benchmarks. That's a really critical thing. Basically, we need standards is what I'm saying. And the standard needs to be more than just say, what was the fidelity of this game? Like it needs to be a bit more, actually. We need something a bit stronger than that. So for me, that's kind of the really interesting thing. Well, is this like going to be a giant watershed moment for the field? I don't know, like time will tell. Like I've had arguments with people who've argued that the really important thing was 3 years ago when they actually said that they were going to do this. Certainly it took, like we mentioned earlier in the interview, like when we began these conversations with Google, which Scott kicked off, we were talking to Sergio Boisio and the other people on the team, and they were like, you know, we're having meetings with John Martinez saying things like, oh yeah, no, we think we can build a 50 qubit device in the next few years. So like, I was like, what? Are you crazy? Like, that is so much bigger than I would have thought. You know, I thought we would have been doing about 15 qubits or something like that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think that they made public to people that this is actually what their plans were. That definitely created a step change in the community and the way that we thought about things. I think that really focused people's attention in a way that hadn't been focused before. That said, you need to actually show that you can do that and that it works, right, in the way that you expect it to. And I think that's what they've done now. So I'm going to be interested to see whether we saw the step change 2 or 3 years ago or is the step change going to be now? Is there another, you know, I think it's going to go up another couple of notches because of this?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we'll find out, I guess.
Well, it sounds like this time. Exactly. It sounds like there's optimism all around.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you cut out a bit there for us.
I was just saying, I think there seems to be a suitable degree of optimism all around.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of optimism. I think One worry that many people have, you may have heard yourself from others, is whether, like, over this like upcoming 5-year period, whether the level of sort of funding and interest from the sort of industrial side is going to be enough to sort of get through this next stage of development of quantum computing. Because I think everyone in the field would agree that like this experiment is not the end of the story. It's very far from it, and it's a very important milestone at the start of the story. And it's going to be really critical that people kind of continue to remain in experimental quantum computing and also on the theory side for the long haul, rather than thinking, okay, well, this is it now. let's go home.
Well, I think that's a great note just to finish on. And we're already well past the hour now, so I think it's time for you guys to go get yourselves a cup of tea or a cup of coffee. But just like to thank all three of you again for taking an hour out of your day this morning. And I hope you spend the rest of the afternoon figuring out what we're going to do with 100 qubits.
Yeah, but at the end of the afternoon, that should do it, right?
Yeah, it should be enough. I think so. Just in time for pub.
Well, you know, you're being paid, so, you know, chop, chop. Anyway, so right. Ashley, Michael, Ryan, thanks again for joining me.
No worries, Simon.
Thanks so much.
See ya.